Side 26. It, by Stephen King. Continuing on page 971. He stared at the underbrush, at the path twisting away through it and back toward Kansas Street, and felt his mind suddenly go up another notch, as if to a higher plane. There was no stuttering in his mind. He felt as if his thoughts had been borne away on a mad flow of intuition, as if everything were coming to him. George at one end, me and my friends at the other. And then it will stop. Again. Again, yes, again, because this has happened before, and there always has to be some sacrifice at the end, some terrible thing to stop it. I don't know how I can know that, but I do, and they let it happen, Bill muttered, staring wide-eyed at the ratty pigtail of path. Sure they did a do. Bill? Bev asked, pleading. Stan stood on one side of her, small and neat in a blue polo shirt and chinos. Mike stood on the other, looking at Bill intensely, as if reading his thoughts. They let it happen. They always do. And things quiet down. Things go on. It sleeps. Sleeps, or hibernates like a bear. And then it starts again, and they know. People know. They know it has to be, so it can be. La-la-la. Oh, please, God, oh, please, God, he thrusts his fists, please, God, against the posts. Let me get this out, the posts, and still insists, oh, God, oh, Christ, oh, please, let me be able to talk. I led you down here, because no place is safe, Bill said. Spittle blabbered from his lips. He wiped them with the back of one hand. The dairy is it. Do you understand, me? He glared at them. They drew away a little, their eyes shiny, almost thanatropic with fright. De Harry is it. Any place we go. When it gets us, they won't see. They won't hear. They won't know. He looked at them, pleading. Don't you see how it is? All we can do is to try and finish what we started. Beverly saw Mr. Ross getting up, looking at her, folding his paper, and simply going into his house. They won't see. They won't hear. They won't know. And my father. Take those pants off, slut child. Had meant to kill her. Mike thought of lunch with Bill. Bill's mother had been off in her own dreamy world, seeming not to see either of them, reading a Henry James novel while the boys made sandwiches and gobbled them standing at the counter. Richie thought of Stan's neat but utterly empty house. Stan had been a little surprised. His mother was almost always home at lunchtime. On the few occasions when she wasn't, she left a note saying where she could be reached. But there had been no note today. The car was gone, and that was all. Probably went shopping with her friend Debbie, Stan said, frowning a little, and had set to work making egg salad sandwiches. Richie had forgotten about it, until now. Eddie thought of his mother. When he had gone out with his Parcheesi board, there had been none of the usual cautions. Be careful, Eddie. Get under cover if it rains. Eddie, don't you dare play any rough games, Eddie. She hadn't asked if he had his aspirator, hadn't told him what time to be home. Hadn't warned him against those rough boys you play with. She had simply gone on watching her soap opera story on TV as if he didn't exist. As if he didn't exist. A version of the same thought went through all of the boys' minds. They had, at some point between getting up this morning and lunchtime, simply become ghosts. Ghosts. Bill, Stan said harshly, if we cut across, through the old cape? Bill shook his head. I don't think so. We'd get caught in the bam-ba-ba-boo. The quick mud. Or there'd be real piranha fish in the Kanduskeeg. Or something else. Each had his or her own different vision of the same end. Ben saw bushes which suddenly became man-eating plants. Beverly saw flying leeches like the ones that had come out of that old refrigerator. Stan saw the mucky ground and the bamboo vomiting up the living corpses of children caught in there by the fabled quick mud. Mike Hanlon imagined small Jurassic reptiles with horrid saw teeth suddenly boiling out of the cleft of a rotten tree, attacking them, biting them to pieces. Richie saw the crawling eye oozing down on top of them as they ran under the railroad trestle. And Eddie saw them climbing the old Cape embankment, only to look up and see the leper standing at the top, his sagging flesh acrawl with beetles and maggots waiting for them. "If we could get out of town somehow," Richie muttered. Then winced as thunder shouted a furious negative from the sky. More rain fell. It was still only squalling, but soon it would begin to come down seriously in sheets and torrents. The day's hazy peace was now utterly gone, as if it had never been at all. "We'd be safe if we could just get out of this fucking town." Beverly began, "Beep, beep," and then a rock came flying out of the shaggy bushes and struck Mike on the side of the head. He staggered backward, blood flowing through the tight cap of his hair, and would have fallen if Bill hadn't caught him. "Teach you to throw rocks?" Henry's voice floated mockingly to them. Bill could see the others looking around, wild-eyed, ready to bolt in six different directions. And if they did that, it would really be over. "Ben," he said sharply. Ben looked at him. "Bill, we gotta run. They..." Two more rocks flew out of the bushes. One struck Stan on the upper thigh. He yelled, more surprised than hurt. Beverly sidestepped the second. It struck the ground and rolled through the clubhouse trap door.
Do you remember the first day you came down here?" Bill shouted over the thunder.
The day who let out?"
"Bill!"
Richie shouted. Bill thrust a shushing hand at him. His eyes remained fixed on Ben, pinning him to the spot.
"Sure," Ben said, miserably trying to look in all directions at once.
The bushes were now wavering and dancing wildly, their motion nearly tidal.
"The drain," Bill said. "The pumping station. That's where we're supposed to go.
Take us there."
"But... take us to there."
A fusillade of rocks whizzed out of the bushes, and for a moment Bill saw Victor Chris's face, somehow frightened, drugged, and avid all at the same time. Then a rock smashed into his cheekbone, and it was Mike's turn to keep Bill from falling down. For a moment he couldn't see straight. His cheek felt numb. Then sensation returned in painful throbs, and he felt blood running down his face. He swiped at his cheek, wincing at the painful knob that was rising there, looked at the blood, wiped it on his jeans. His hair whipped wildly in the freshening wind.
"Teach you to throw rocks, you stuttering asshole!" Henry half laughed, half screamed.
"Take us!"
Bill yelled. He understood now why he had sent Eddie back to get Ben. It was that pumping station they were supposed to go to, that very one, and only Ben knew exactly which one it was. They ran along both banks of the Kenduskeek at irregular intervals.
"It hits the place, the way in, the way to it."
"Bill, you can't know that," Beverly cried.
He shouted furiously at her, at all of them.
"I know."
Ben stood there for a moment, wetting his lips, looking at Bill. Then he struck off across the clearing, heading toward the river. A brilliant bolt of lightning streaked across the sky, purplish-white, followed by a rip of thunder that made Bill reel on his feet. A fist-sized chunk of rock sailed past his nose and struck Ben's buttocks. He yipped with pain, and his hand went to the spot.
"Yeah, fat boy," Henry cried in that same half-laughing, half-screaming voice.
The bushes rustled and crashed, and Henry appeared as the rain stopped fooling around and came in a downpour. Water ran in Henry's crew cut, in his eyebrows, down his cheeks. His grin showed all his teeth.
"Teach you to throw rock."
Mike had found one of the pieces of scrap wood left over from building the clubhouse roof, and now he threw it. It flipped over twice and struck Henry's forehead. He screamed, clapped one hand to the spot like a man who's just had one hell of a good idea, and sat down hard.
"Run!" Bill hollered. "After Ben!"
More crashings and stumblings in the bushes, and as the rest of the losers ran after Ben Hanscom, Victor and Belch appeared. Henry stood up, and the three of them gave chase. Even later, when the rest of that day had come back to Ben, he recalled only jumbled images of their run through the bushes. He remembered branches overloaded with dripping leaves slapping against his face, dousing him with cold water. He remembered that the thunder and lightning seemed to have become almost constant. And he remembered that Henry's screams for them to come back and fight seemed to merge with the sound of the Kenduskeeg as they drew closer to it. Every time he slowed, Bill would whack him on the back to make him hurry up.
What if I can't find it? What if I can't find that particular pumping station? The breath tore in and out of his lungs, hot and bloody tasting in the back of his throat. A stitch was sinking into his side. His buttocks sang where the rock had hit him. Beverly had said Henry and his friends meant to kill them, and Ben believed it now. Yes, he did. He came to the Kenduskeag's bank so suddenly that he nearly plunged over the edge. He managed to get his balance, and then the embankment, undercut by the spring runoff, collapsed, and he went tumbling over anyway, skidding all the way to the edge of the fast-running water, his shirt rucking up in the back, clayey mud streaking and sticking to his skin. Bill piled into him and yanked him to his feet. The others burst out of the bushes which overhung the bank, one after the other. Richie and Eddie were last, Richie with one arm slung around Eddie's waist, his dripping specks clinging precariously to the end of his nose.
Where?
Bill shouted. Ben looked first left and then right, aware that the time was suicidally short. The river seemed higher already, and the rain-dark sky had given it a dangerous slate-gray color as it boiled its way along. Its banks were choked with underbrush and stunted trees, all of them now dancing to the wind's tune. He could hear Eddie sobbing for breath.
Where?
I don't know, he began, and then he saw the leaning tree and the eroded cave beneath it. That was where he had hidden that first day. He had dozed off, and when he woke up, he had heard Bill and Eddie goofing around. Then the big boys had come. Seen. Conquered.
Ta-ta, boys. It was a real baby dam, believe me.
There, he shouted. That way. Lightning flashed again, and this time Ben could hear it, a buzzing noise like an overloaded Lionel train transformer. It struck the tree, and blue-white electric fire sizzled its gnarly base into splinters and toothpicks sized for a fairy tale giant. It fell toward the river with a rending crash, driving spray high into the air. Ben drew in a dismayed gasp and smelled something hot and punky and wild. A fireball rolled up the bole of the downed tree, seemed to flash brighter, and went out. Thunder exploded, not above them, but around them, as if they stood in the center of the thunderclap. The rain sheeted down. Bill thumped him on the back, awaking him from his dazed contemplation of these things.
Go!
Ben went, splashing and stumbling along the verge of the river, his hair hanging in his eyes. He reached the tree, the little root cave beneath it had been obliterated, and climbed over it, digging his toes into its wet hide, scraping his hands and forearms. Bill and Richie manhandled Eddie over, and as he stumbled off the tree trunk, Ben caught him. They both went tumbling to the ground. Eddie cried out.
You all right?
Ben shouted.
I guess so,
Eddie shouted back, getting to his feet. He fumbled for his aspirator and almost dropped it. Ben grabbed it for him, and Eddie gave him a grateful look as he stuffed it into his mouth and triggered it. Richie came over, then Stan and Mike. Bill boosted Beverly up onto the tree, and Ben and Richie caught her coming down on the far side, her hair plastered to her head, her blue jeans now black. Bill came last, pulling himself onto the trunk and swinging his legs around. He saw Henry and the other two splashing down the river toward them, and as he slid off the fallen tree, he shouted, "River rocks! Throw rocks!" There were plenty of them here on the bank, and the lightning-struck tree made a perfect barricade. In a moment or two, all seven of them were chucking rocks at Henry and his pals. They had nearly reached the tree. The range was point-blank. They were driven back, yelling with pain and fury, as rocks struck their faces, their chests, their arms and legs.
"Teach us to throw rocks," Richie shouted, and chucked one the size of a hen's egg at Victor.
It struck his shoulder and bounced almost straight up into the air. Victor howled.
I say, go on and teach us, boy. We learn good.
"Yeah," Mike screamed. "How do you like it? How do you like it?"
The answer was not much. They retreated until they were out of range and huddled together. A moment later they climbed the bank, slipping and stumbling on the slick, wet earth, which was already honeycombed with little running streamlets holding onto branches to stay upright. They disappeared into the underbrush.
"They're going to go around us, Big Bill," Richie said, pushing his glasses up on his nose.
"That's okay," Bill said. "Go on, Ben. We'll follow you. Ben trotted along the embankment, paused, expecting that Henry and the others would burst out into his face at any moment, and saw the pumping station 20 yards farther down the stream bed. The others followed him to it. They could see other cylinders on the opposite bank, one fairly close, the other 40 yards upstream. Those two were both shooting torrents of muddy water into the Kenduskeag, but only a trickle was coming from the pipe sticking out of the embankment below this one. It wasn't humming either, Ben noticed. The pumping machinery had broken down. He looked at Bill thoughtfully, and with some fright.
Bill was looking at Richie, Stan, and Mike.
We gotta get the lid off, he said. Help me.
There were handholds in the iron, but the rain had made them slippery, and the lid itself was incredibly heavy. Ben moved in next to Bill, and Bill shifted his hands a little to make room. Ben could hear water dripping inside, an echoey, unpleasant sound, like water dripping into a well.
Now,
Bill shouted, and the five of them heaved in unison. The lid moved with an ugly grating sound. Beverly grabbed on beside Richie, and Eddie pushed with his good arm.
1, 2, 3, push, Richie chanted.
The lid grated a little farther off the top of the cylinder. Now a crescent of darkness showed.
1, 2, 3, push.
The crescent fattened.
1, 2, 3, push.
Ben shoved until red spots danced in front of his eyes.
Stand back, Mike shouted. There it goes, there it goes.
They stood away and watched as the big circular cap overbalanced, then fell. It dug a slash in the wet earth and landed upside down like an oversized checker. Beetles scurried off its surface and into the matted grass.
Uck, Eddie said.
Bill peered inside. Iron rungs descended to a circular pool of black water, its surface now pocked with raindrops. The silent pump brooded in the middle of this, half submerged. He could see water flowing into the pumping station from the mouth of its inflow pipe, and with a sinking in his guts, he thought,
that's where we have to go, in there.
Eddie, grab onto me.
Eddie looked at him, uncomprehending.
Like a piggerback. Hold on with your good arm,
he demonstrated. Eddie understood, but was reluctant.
Quick, Bill snapped. They'll be here.
Eddie grabbed on around Bill's neck. Stan and Mike boosted him up so he could hook his legs around Bill's midsection. As Bill swung clumsily over the lip of the cylinder, Ben saw that Eddie's eyes were tightly shut. Over the rain, he could hear another sound. Whipping branches, snapping twigs, voices. Henry, Victor, and Belch. The world's ugliest cavalry charge. Bill gripped the rough concrete lip of the cylinder and felt his way down, step by careful step. The iron rungs were slippery. Eddie had him in what was almost a death grip, and Bill supposed he was getting a pretty graphic demonstration of what Eddie's asthma was really all about.
I'm scared, Bill,
Eddie whispered.
I am too.
He let go of the concrete rim and grabbed the topmost rung. Although Eddie was nearly choking him and felt as if he had already gained 40 pounds, Bill paused a moment, looking at the barrens, the Kanduskeag, the racing clouds. A voice inside, not a frightened voice, just a firm one, had told him to take a good look in case he never saw the upper world again. So he looked, then began to descend with Eddie clinging to his back.
I can't hold on much longer, Eddie managed.
You won't have to, Bill said. We're almost down.
One of his feet went into chilly water. He felt for the next rung and found it. There was another below that, and then the ladder ended. He was standing in knee-deep water beside the pump. He squatted, wincing as the cold water soaked his pants, and let Eddie off. He drew a deep breath. The smell wasn't so hot, but it was great not to have Eddie's arm wrapped around his throat. He looked up at the cylinder's mouth. It was about 10 feet over his head. The others were grouped around the rim, looking down.
Come on, he shouted. Well, one at a time. Be quick.
Beverly came first, swinging easily over the rim and grabbing the ladder, and Stan next. The others followed. Richie came last, pausing to listen to the progress of Henry and friends. He thought, from the sound of their blundering progress, that they would probably pass a little to the left of this pumping station, but almost certainly not by enough to make a difference. At that moment, Victor bellowed,
Henry, there, Tozier!
Richie looked around and saw them rushing toward him. Victor was in the lead, and then Henry pushed him aside so savagely that Victor skidded to his knees. Henry had a knife, all right, a regular pig sticker. Drops of water were falling from the blade. Richie glanced into the cylinder, saw Ben and Stan helping Mike off the ladder, and swung over himself. Henry understood what he was doing and screamed at him. Richie, laughing crazily, slammed his left hand in the crook of his right elbow and stuck his forearm skyward, his hand fisted in what may be the world's oldest gesture. To be sure, Henry got the point. He popped his middle finger up.
You'll die down there,
Henry shouted.
Prove it,
Richie shouted, laughing. He was terrified of going into this concrete throat, but he still couldn't stop laughing. And in his Irish cop's voice he bugled,
Sure and begorra, the luck of the Irish niver runs out, me foine lad.
Henry slipped on the wet grass and went sprawling on his butt less than 20 feet from where Richie stood. His feet on the top rung of the ladder bolted to the inner curb of the pumping station, his head and chest out.
"Hey, banana heels!"
Richie shouted, delirious with triumph, and then scooted down the ladder. The iron rungs were slick, and once he almost fell. Then Bill and Mike grabbed him, and he was standing up to his knees in water with the rest of them in a loose circle around the pump. He was trembling all over. He felt hot and cold chills chasing each other up his back, and still he couldn't stop laughing.
"You should have seen him, Big Bill. Clumsy as ever. Still can't get out of his own frockin' way."
Henry's head appeared in the circular opening at the top. Scratches from branches and brambles crisscrossed his cheeks. His mouth was working, and his eyes blazed.
"Okay,"
he shouted down at them. His words had a flat resonance inside the concrete cylinder, not quite an echo.
"Here I come. Got you now."
He swung one leg over, felt for the topmost rung with his foot, found it, swung the other one over. Speaking loud, Bill said,
"Well, when he gets to the down close enough, will we all grab him, pull him to the down, duck him under. Got it?"
"Righto, Governor,"
Richie said, and snapped a salute with one trembling hand.
"Got you,"
Ben said. Stan tipped a wink at Eddie, who didn't understand what was going on, except it seemed to him that Richie had gone crazy. He was laughing like a loon while Henry Bowers, the dreaded Henry Bowers, prepared to come down and kill them all like rats in a rain barrel.
"All ready for him, Bill," Stan cried.
Henry froze three rungs down. He looked down at the losers over his shoulder. His face seemed, for the first time, doubtful. Eddie suddenly got it. If they came down, they would have to come one at a time. It was too high to jump, especially with the pumping machinery to land on, and here they were, the seven of them, waiting in a tight little circle.
"Kukahuma on, huh, Henry?"
Bill said pleasantly. "Well,
what are you waiting for?"
"That's right," Richie chimed in. "You like to beat up little kids, right? Come on, Henry."
"We're waiting, Henry," Bev said sweetly. "I don't think you'll like it when you get down here, but come on if you want to."
"Unless you're chicken,"
Ben added. He began to make chicken sounds. Richie joined him at once, and soon all of them were doing it. The derisive clucking rebounded between the damp, trickling walls. Henry looked down at them, the knife clutched in his left hand, his face the color of old bricks. He put up with perhaps 30 seconds of it, and then climbed out again. The losers sent up catcalls and insults.
Okay, Bill said. He spoke in a lower voice. "Well, we got to get into that drain. Quick.
"Why?"
Beverly asked. But Bill was spared the effort of an answer. Henry reappeared at the rim of the pumping station and dropped a rock the size of a soccer ball into the pipe. Beverly screamed, and Stan pulled Eddie against the circular wall with a hoarse yell. The rock struck the pumping machinery's rusty housing and produced a musical bong. It ricocheted left and struck the concrete wall, missing Eddie by less than half a foot. A chip of the concrete flicked painfully against his cheek. The rock fell into the water with a splash.
Quick,
Bill shouted again, and they crowded around the pumping station's inflow pipe. Its bore was about 5 feet in diameter. Bill sent them in one after another. A vague circus image, all the big clowns coming out of the little car, passed across his consciousness in a meteoric flash. Years later, he would use the same image in a book called The Black Rapids, and climbed in last, after ducking another rock. As they watched, more rocks flew down, most striking the pump housing and rebounding at crazy angles. When they stopped falling, Bill looked out and saw Henry coming down the ladder again, as quick as he could.
Get him, he shouted to the others.
Richie, Ben, and Mike floundered out behind Bill. Richie leaped high and grabbed Henry's ankle. Henry cursed and shook his leg as if trying to kick away a small dog with big teeth. A terrier, perhaps, or a Pekingese. Richie grabbed a rung, scrambled up even higher, and actually did manage to sink his teeth into Henry's ankle. Henry screamed and pulled himself up quickly. One of his loafers came off and splashed into the water, where it sank with no ado at all.
"Bit me," Henry was screaming. "Bit me, cocksucker, bit me."
"Yeah, good thing I had a tetanus shot this spring," Richie flung at him.
"Bash them," Henry was raving. "Bash them, bomb them back to the Stone Age. Bash their brains in."
More rocks flew. The boys backed into the drain again quickly. Mike was struck in the arm by a small rock, and he held it tight, wincing, until the pain began to abate.
"It's a standoff," Ben said. "They can't get down, and we can't get up."
"We're not supposed to get up,"
Bill said quietly.
"And you all know it.
Well, we're not ever supposed to get up again.
They looked at him, their eyes hurt and afraid. No one said anything. Henry's voice, fury masquerading as mockery, floated down.
We can wait up here all day, you guys.
Beverly had turned away and was looking back along the bore of the inflow pipe. The light grew diffuse quickly, and she could not see much. What she could see was a concrete tunnel, its lower third filled with rushing water. It was higher on her now than it had been when they first squeezed in here, she realized. That would be because this pump wasn't working and only some of the water was exiting on the Kanduskeag side. She felt claustrophobia touch her throat, turning the skin there to something that felt like flannel. If the water rose enough, they would drown.
Bill, do we have to?
He shrugged. It said everything. Yeah, they had to. What else was there? Be killed by Henry, Victor, and Belch and the Barons? Or by something else, maybe something worse, in town? She understood his thought well enough now. There was no stutter in his shrug. Better for them to go to it. Have it out, like the showdown in a Western movie. Cleaner, braver. Richie said,
What was that ritual you told us about, Big Bill? The one in the library book?
Ch-ch-chud, Bill said, smiling a little.
Chud,
Richie nodded.
You bite its tongue, and it bites yours, right?
Right.
Then you tell jokes.
Bill nodded.
Funny,
Richie said, looking into the dark pipe.
I can't think of a single one.
Me either, Ben said.
The fear was heavy in his chest, almost suffocating. He felt that the only thing keeping him from just sitting down in the water and blubbering like a baby, or just going crazy, was Bill's calm, sure presence. And Beverly. He felt he would rather die than show Beverly how afraid he was.
Do you know where this pipe goes?
Stan asked Bill. Bill shook his head.
Do you know how to find it?
Bill shook his head again. We'll know when we're getting close, Richie said suddenly. He drew a deep, trembling breath.
If we have to do it, then let's go.
Bill nodded.
I'll be first, then Eddie.
Ben, Bev,
Stahan the man, Mike.
You last, Richie.
Everyone keep one hand on the shoulder of the person in front of you. It's going to be dark.
You coming out?
Henry Bowers shrieked down at them.
We're going to come out somewhere,
Richie muttered, I guess. They formed up like a procession of blind men. Bill looked back once, confirming that each had a hand on the shoulder of the person ahead. Then, bending forward slightly against the rush of the current, Bill Dendro led his friends into the dark, where the boat he had made for his brother had gone almost a year before. Chapter 20. The Circle Closes. 1. Tom. Tom Rogan was having one fuck of a crazy dream. In it, he was killing his father. Part of his mind understood how crazy this was. His father had died when Tom was only in the third grade. Well, maybe died wasn't such a good word. Maybe committed suicide was actually the truth. Ralph Rogan had made himself a gin and lie cocktail. One for the road, you might say. Tom had been put in nominal charge of his brother and sisters, and he began to receive weapons if anything went wrong with them. So he couldn't have killed his father. Except there he was, in this frightening dream, holding what looked like a harmless handle of some sort to his father's neck. Only it wasn't really harmless, was it? There was a button in the end of the handle, and if he pushed it, a blade would pop out and go right through his father's neck.
I'm not going to do anything like that, Daddy, don't worry, his dreaming mind thought just before his finger jammed down on the button and the blade popped out.
His father's sleeping eyes opened and stared up at the ceiling. His father's mouth opened and a bloody, gargling sound came out.
Daddy, I didn't do it, his mind screamed. Someone else.
He struggled to wake up and couldn't. The best he could do, and it turned out to be not very good at all, was to fade into a new dream. In this one he was splashing and slogging his way down a long, dark tunnel. His balls hurt and his face stung because it was crisscrossed with scratches. There were others with him, but he could only make out vague shapes. It didn't matter anyway. What mattered were the kids somewhere up ahead. They needed to pay. They needed a weapon to be punished. Whatever purgatory this was, it was a smelly one. Water dripped and echoed. His shoes and pants were soaked. The little shitpots were somewhere up ahead in this maze of tunnels, and perhaps they thought,
Henry,
Tom and his friends would get lost, but the joke was on them.
Ha ha, all over you.
because he had another friend, oh yes, a special friend, and this friend had marked the path they were to take with moon balloons. Thingamajigs that were big and round and somehow lighted from within so that they shed a glow like that which falls mysteriously from old-fashioned street lamps. One of these balloons floated and drifted at each intersection, and on the side of each was an arrow pointing the way into the tunnel branch he and Belch and Victor, his unseen friends, were to take. And it was the right path, oh yes. He could hear the others ahead, their splashing progress echoing back, the distorted murmurs of their voices. They were getting closer, catching up. And when they did, Tom looked down and saw that he still had the switch knife in his hand. For a moment he was frightened. This was like one of those crazy astral experiences he sometimes read about in the weekly tabloids, when your spirit left your body and entered someone else's. The shape of his body felt different to him, as if he were not Tom, but Henry. Someone else. Someone younger. He began to fight his way out of the dream, panicked, and then a voice was talking to him, a soothing voice whispering in his ear. It doesn't matter when this is, and it doesn't matter who you are. What matters is that Beverly is up there. She's with them, my good friend. And you know what? She's been doing something one hell of a lot worse than sneaking smokes. You know what? She's been fucking her old friend Bill Denbrough. Yes, indeed. She and that stuttering freak going right at it. They... That's a lie, he tried to scream. She wouldn't dare. But he knew it was no lie. She had used a belt on his... Kick me in the... balls and run off, and she now had cheated on him, the slutty child. Little Round Heels bitch had actually cheated on him. And oh, dear friends, oh, good neighbors, she was going to get the weapon of all weapons. First her, and then Denbrough, her novel-writing friend. And anyone who tried to get in his way, you could count them in for a piece of the action, too. He stepped up his pace, although the breath was already whistling in and out of his throat. Up ahead he could see another luminous circle bobbing in the darkness, another moon balloon. He could hear the voices of the people ahead of him, and the fact that they were childish voices no longer bothered him. It was as the voice said. It didn't matter where, when, or who. Beverly was up there. And oh, dear friends, oh, good neighbors. Come on, you guys, move your asses, he said. And it didn't even matter that his voice wasn't his own, but the voice of a boy. Then, as they approached the moon balloon, he looked around and saw his companions for the first time. Both of them were dead. One was headless. The face of the other had been split open as if by a great talon. "We're moving as fast as we can, Henry," the boy with the split face said, and his lips moved in two pieces, grotesquely out of sync with each other. And that was when Tom shrieked the dream to pieces and came back to himself, tottering on the brink of what felt like some great empty space. He struggled to keep his balance, lost it, and tumbled to the floor. The floor was carpeted, but the fall still sent a sickening burst of pain through his hurt knee, and he stifled another cry against his forearm. Where am I? Where the fuck am I? He became aware of a faint but clear white light, and for a frightening moment he thought he was back in the dream again, that it was light cast by one of those crazy balloons. Then he remembered leaving the bathroom door partially open and the fluorescent light in there on. He always left the light on when staying in a strange place. It saved you barking your shins if you had to get up in the night to pee. That clicked reality into place. It had been a dream, all some crazy dream. He was in a Holiday Inn. This was Derry, Maine. He had chased his wife here, and in the middle of a crazy nightmare, he had fallen out of bed. That was all. That was the long and the short of it. That wasn't just a nightmare. He jumped as if the words had been spoken beside his ear instead of inside his own mind. It didn't seem like his own interior voice at all. It was cold, alien, but somehow hypnotic and believable. He got up slowly, fumbled a glass of water off the table beside the bed, and drank it down. He ran shaky hands through his hair. The clock on the table said 3:10. Go back to sleep. Wait until morning. That alien voice answered, but there will be people around in the morning, too many people. And besides, you can beat them down there this time. This time you can be first. Down there? He thought of his dream, the water, the dripping dark. The light suddenly seemed brighter. He turned his head, not wanting to, but helpless to stop. A groan slipped out of his mouth. A balloon was tied to the knob of the bathroom door. It floated at the end of a string about 3 feet long. The balloon glowed, full of a ghostly white light. It looked like a will-o'-the-wisp glimpsed in a swamp, floating dreamily between trees overhung with gray ropes of moss.
An arrow was printed on the balloon's gently bulging skin, an arrow that was blood scarlet. It was pointing at the door leading out into the hall.
"It doesn't really matter who I am," the voice said soothingly, and Tom realized now that it wasn't coming from either his own head or from beside his ear. It was coming from the balloon, from the center of that strange, lovely white light.
"All that matters is that I am going to see that everything turns out to your satisfaction, Tom. I want to see her take a weapon. I want to see them all take a weapon. They've crossed my path once too often, and much too late in the day for them. So listen, Tom. Listen very carefully. All together now. Follow the bouncing ball."
Tom listened. The voice from the balloon explained. It explained everything. When it was done, it popped in one final flash of light, and Tom began to dress. 2.
Audra.
Audra also had nightmares. She awoke with a start, sitting bolt upright in bed, the sheet pulled around her waist, her small breasts moving with her quick, agitated breathing. Like Tom's, her dreaming had been a jumbled, distressful experience. Like Tom, she had had the sensation of being someone else, or rather, of having her own consciousness deposited, and partially submerged, in another body and another mind. She had been in a dark place with a number of others around her, and she had been aware of an oppressive sensation of danger. They were going into the danger deliberately, and she wanted to scream at them to stop, to explain to her what was happening. But the person with whom she had merged seemed to know, and to believe it was necessary. She was also aware that they were being chased, and that their pursuers were catching up little by little. Bill had been in the dream, but his story about how he had forgotten his childhood must have been on her mind, because in her dream Bill was only a boy, 10 or 12 years old. He still had all his hair. She was holding his hand, and was dimly aware that she loved him very much, and that her willingness to go on was based on the rock-solid belief that Bill would protect her and all of them, that Bill, Big Bill, would somehow bring them through this and back into the daylight again. Oh, but she was so terrified. They came to a branching of many tunnels, and Bill stood there, looking from one to the next, and one of the others, a boy with his arm in a cast, which glimmered a ghostly white in the darkness, spoke up.
"That one, Bill, the bottom one."
You're sure?
Yes.
And so they had gone that way, and then there had been a door, a wee wooden door no more than 3 feet high, the sort of door you might see in a fairy tale book, and there had been a mark on the door. She could not remember what that mark had been, what strange rune or symbol. But it had brought all her terror to a focusing point, and she had yanked herself out of that other body, that girl's body, whoever.
Beverly. Beverly.
She might have been. She awoke bolt upright in a strange bed, sweaty, wide-eyed, gasping as if she had just run a race. Her hands flew to her legs, half expecting to find them wet and cold with the water she had been walking through in her head. But she was dry. Disorientation followed. This was not their home in Topanga Canyon or the rented house in Fleet. It was no place. Limbo furnished with a bed, a dresser, 2 chairs, and a TV.
"Oh, God, come on, Audra."
She scrubbed her hands viciously across her face, and that sickening feeling of mental vertigo receded. She was in Derry, Maine, where her husband had grown through a childhood he claimed no longer to remember. Not a familiar place to her, or a particularly good place by its feel, but at least a known place. She was here because Bill was here, and she would see him tomorrow at the Derry townhouse. Whatever terrible thing was wrong here, whatever those new scars on his hands meant, they would face it together. She would call him, tell him she was here, then join him. After that, well, actually she had no idea what came after that. The vertigo, that sense of being in a place that was really no place, was threatening again. When she was 19, she had done a whistle-stop tour with a scraggy little production company, 40 not-so-wonderful performances of arsenic and old lace in 40 not-so-wonderful towns and small cities. All of this in 47 not-so-wonderful days. They began at the Peabody Dinner Theater in Massachusetts and ended at Play It Again, Sam, in Sausalito. And somewhere in between, in some Midwestern town like Ames, Iowa, or Grand Isle, Nebraska, or maybe Jubilee, North Dakota, she had awakened like this in the middle of the night, panicked by disorientation, unsure what town she was in, what day it was, or why she was wherever she was. Even her name seemed unreal to her. That feeling was back now. Her bad dreams had carried over into her waking, and she felt a nightmarish, free-floating terror.
The town seemed to have wrapped itself around her like a python. She could sense it, and the feelings it produced were not good. She found herself wishing that she had heeded Freddy's advice and stayed away. Her mind fixed on Bill, grasping at the thought of him the way a drowning woman would grip at a spar, a life preserver, anything that... "We all float down here, Audra. Floats." A chill raced through her, and she crisscrossed her arms across her naked breasts. She shivered and saw goosebumps ripple their way up her flesh. For a moment, it seemed to her that a voice had spoken aloud, but inside her head, as if there was an alien presence in there. "Am I going crazy? God, is that it?" "No," her mind responded. "It's just disorientation, jet lag, worry over your man. Nobody's talking inside your head. Nobody." "We all float down here, Audra," a voice said from the bathroom. It was a real voice, real as houses. "And sly, sly and dirty and evil. You'll float too." The voice uttered a fruity little giggle that dropped in pitch until it sounded like a clogged drain bubbling thickly. Audra cried out, then pressed her hands against her mouth. "I didn't hear that." She said it out loud, daring the voice to contradict her. It didn't. The room was silent. Somewhere, far away, a train whistled in the night. Suddenly she needed Bill so badly that waiting until daylight seemed impossible. She was in a standardized motel room exactly like the other 39 units in the place, but suddenly it was too much, everything. When you started hearing voices, it was just too much, too creepy. She seemed to be slipping back into the nightmare she'd so lately escaped. She felt scared and terribly alone. "It's worse than that," she thought. "I feel dead." Her heart suddenly skipped two beats in her chest, making her gasp and utter a startled cough. She felt an instant of prison panic, claustrophobia inside her own body, and wondered if all this terror didn't have a stupidly ordinary physical root after all. Maybe she was going to have a heart attack, or was already having one. Her heart settled, but uneasily. Audra turned on the light by the bed table and looked at her watch. 3:12. He would be sleeping, but that didn't matter to her now. Nothing mattered except hearing his voice. She wanted to finish the night with him. If Bill was beside her, her clockwork would fall in sync with his and settle down. The nightmares would stay away. He sold nightmares to others. That was his trade. But to her, he had never given anything but peace. Outside that odd, cold nut embedded in his imagination, peace seemed to be all he was made for or meant for. She got the yellow pages, found the number for the Derry townhouse, and dialed it.
"Derry townhouse.
Would you please ring Mr. Denbrough's room, Mr. William Denbrough?"
"Does that guy ever get any calls in the daytime?" the clerk said. And before she could think to ask what that was supposed to mean, he had plugged her call through.
The phone burred once, twice, three times. She could imagine him sleeping with everything under the covers except the top of his head. She could imagine one hand coming out, feeling for the phone. She had seen him do it before, and a fond little smile touched her lips. It faded as the phone rang a fourth time, and a fifth, and a sixth. Halfway through the seventh ring, the connection was broken.
"That room does not answer."
"No shit, Sherlock," Audra said, more upset and frightened than ever. "Are you sure you rang the right room?"
"Yep," the clerk said. "Mr. Denbrough had an inter-room call not 5 minutes ago. I know he answered that one because the light stayed on the switchboard a minute or two. He must have gone to the person's room."
"Well, which room was it?"
"I don't remember. Sixth floor, I think, but..."
She dropped the phone back into its cradle. A queer, disheartening certainty came to her. It was a woman. Some woman had called him, and he had gone to her. "Well, what now, Audra? How do we handle this?" She felt tears threaten. They stung her eyes and her nose. She could feel the lump of a sob in the back of her throat. No anger, at least not yet, only a sick sense of loss and abandonment.
"Audra, get hold of yourself. You're jumping to conclusions. It's the middle of the night and you had a bad dream and now you've got Bill with some other woman. But it ain't necessarily so. What you're going to do is sit up. You'll never get back to sleep now anyway. Turn on some lights and finish the novel you brought to read on the plane. Remember what Bill says? Finest kind of dope. Book volume. No more heebie-jeebies, no more whim-whams and hearing voices. Dorothy Sayers and Lord Peter, that's the ticket. The Nine Tailors. That'll take you through to dawn. That'll..."
The bathroom light suddenly went on. She could see it under the door. Then the latch clicked and the door juddered open. She stared at this, eyes widening, arms instinctively crossing over her breasts again.
Her heart began to slam against her rib cage, and the sour taste of adrenaline flooded her mouth. That voice, low and dragging, said, "We all float down here, Audra." The last word became a long, low, fading scream. "Audra." That ended once again in that sick, clogged, bubbly sound that was so much like laughter. "Who's there?" she cried, backing away. "That wasn't my imagination. No way. You're not going to tell me that." The TV clicked on. She whirled around and saw a clown in a silvery suit with big orange buttons capering around on the screen. There were black sockets where its eyes should have been, and when its made-up lips stretched even wider in a grin, she saw teeth like razors. It held up a dripping, severed head. Its eyes were turned up to the whites, and the mouth sagged open. But she could see well enough that it was Freddy Firestone's head. The clown laughed and danced. It swung the head around, and drops of blood splashed against the inside of the TV screen. She could hear them sizzling in there. Audra tried to scream, and nothing came out but a little whine. She grabbed blindly for the dress lying over the back of the chair and for her purse. She bolted into the hall and slammed the door behind her, gasping, her face paper white. She dropped the purse between her feet and slipped the dress over her head.
"Float,"
a low, chuckling voice said from behind her, and she felt a cold finger caress her bare heel. She uttered another high, out-of-breath scream and danced away from the door. White corpse fingers were seeking back and forth under it. The nails peeled away to show purplish, white, bloodless quicks. They made hoarse whispering noises on the rough nap of the hall carpet. Audra snagged the strap of her purse and ran barefooted for the door at the end of the corridor. She was in a blind panic now, her only thought that she had to find the Derry townhouse and Bill. It didn't matter if he was in bed with enough other women to make up a harem. She would find him and get him to take her away from whatever unspeakable thing there was in this town. She fled down the walkway and into the parking lot, looking around wildly for her car. For a moment her mind froze and she couldn't even remember what she had been driving. Then it came. Datsun, tobacco brown. She spotted it standing hubcap deep in the still, curdled ground mist and hurried over to it. She couldn't find the keys in her purse. She swept through it with steadily increasing panic, shuffling Kleenex, cosmetics, change, sunglasses, and sticks of gum into a meaningless jumble. She didn't notice the battered LTD wagon parked nose-to-nose with her rented car, or the man sitting behind the wheel. She didn't notice when the LTD's door opened and the man got out. She was trying to cope with the growing certainty that she had left the Datsun's keys in the room. She couldn't go back in there. She couldn't. Her fingers touched hard serrated metal under a box of Altoid mints, and she seized at it with a little cry of triumph. For a terrible moment she thought it might be the key to their rover, now sitting in the Fleet Railway Station's car park 3,000 miles away, and then she felt the Lucite rental car tab. She fumbled the key into the door lock, breathing in harsh little gasps, and turned it. That was when a hand fell on her shoulder and she screamed, screamed loudly this time. Somewhere a dog barked in answer, but that was all. The hand, as hard as steel, bit cruelly in and forced her around. The face she saw looming over hers was puffed and lumpy. The eyes glittered. When the swelled lips spread in a grotesque smile, she saw that some of the man's front teeth had been broken. The stumps looked jagged and savage. She tried to speak and could not. The hand squeezed tighter, digging in.
"Haven't I seen you in the movies?"
Tom Rogan whispered. 3. Eddie's room. Beverly and Bill dressed quickly, without speaking, and went up to Eddie's room. On their way to the elevator, they heard a phone bell begin somewhere behind them. It was muffled, a somewhere else sound.
"Bill, was that yours?"
"Could have been," he said. "One of the others calling, maybe."
He punched the up button. Eddie opened the door for them, his face white and strained. His left arm was at an angle both peculiar and weirdly evocative of old times.
"I'm okay," he said. "I took 2 Darvon. Pain's not bad right now."
But it was clearly not good, either. His lips, pressed so tightly together they had almost disappeared, were purple with shock. Bill looked past him and saw the body on the floor. One look was enough to satisfy him of 2 things. It was Henry Bowers, and he was dead. He moved past Eddie and knelt by the body. The neck of a Perrier bottle had been driven into Henry's midsection, pulling the tatters of his shirt in after it. Henry's eyes were half open, glazed. His mouth, filled with coagulating blood, snarled. His hands were claws. A shadow fell over him and Bill looked up. It was Beverly. She looked down at Henry with no expression at all.
"All the times he chased us," Bill said.
She nodded.
He doesn't look old. You know that, Bill? He doesn't look old at all.
Abruptly, she looked back at Eddie, who was sitting on the bed. Eddie looked old, old and haggard. His arm lay in his lap, useless.
We've got to call the doctor for Eddie.
No, Bill and Eddie said in unison.
But he's hurt, his arm.
It's the same as the last time, Bill said. He got to his feet and held her by the arms, looking into her face.
Once we go outside, once we involve the town, they'll arrest me for murder,
Eddie said dully. Or they'll arrest all of us, or they'll detain us, or something. Then there'll be an accident, one of the special accidents that only happen in Derry. Maybe they'll stick us in jail and a deputy sheriff will go berserk and shoot us all. Maybe we'll all die of ptomaine or decide to hang ourselves in our cells.
Eddie, that's crazy. That's...
Is it? He asked.
Remember, this is Derry.
But we're grown-ups now. Surely you don't think... I mean, he came here in the middle of the night, attacked you.
Well, with what?
Bill said.
Where's the knife?
She looked around, didn't see it, and dropped on her knees to look under the bed.
Don't bother,
Eddie said in that same faint, whistly voice.
I slammed the door on his arm when he tried to stick me with it. He dropped it, and I kicked it under the TV. It's gone now. I already looked.
Heverly, call the others, Bill said.
I can splint Eddie's arm, I think.
She looked at him for a long moment, then she looked down at the body on the floor again. She thought that the picture this room presented should tell a perfectly clear story to any policeman with half a brain. The place was a mess. Eddie's arm was broken. This man was dead. It was a clear case of self-defense against a night prowler. And then she remembered Mr. Ross. Mr. Ross getting up and looking, and then simply folding his newspaper and going back into the house.
Once we go outside, once we involve the town...
That made her remember Bill as a kid, his face white and tired and half crazy. Bill saying,
Derry is it. Do you understand me? Any place we go, when it gets us, they won't see, they won't hear, they won't know. Don't you see how it is? All we can do is try and finish what we started.
Standing here now, looking down at Henry's corpse, Beverly thought,
they're both saying we've all become ghosts again. That it started to repeat, all of it. As a kid, I could accept that, because kids almost are ghosts. But...
Are you sure? She asked desperately. Bill, are you sure? He was sitting on the bed with Eddie, gently touching his arm. Aren't you you? He asked. After all that's happened to today? Yes, all that had happened. The gruesome mess at the end of their reunion, the beautiful old woman who had turned into a crone before her eyes.
My father was also my mother.
The round of stories at the library tonight with the accompanying phenomena. All of those things. And still, her mind shouted at her desperately to stop this now, to spike it with sanity, because if she did not, they were surely going to finish up this night by going down to the Barrens and finding a certain pumping station and...
I don't know, she said. I don't know.
Even after everything that's happened, Bill, it seems to me that we could call the police, maybe.
Call the others, he said again. We'll see what they think.
All right. She called Richie first, then Ben. Both agreed to come right away. Neither asked what had happened. She found Mike's telephone number in the book and dialed it. There was no answer. After a dozen rings, she hung up.
To try the Lula library, Bill said.
He had taken the short curtain rods down from the smaller of the two windows in Eddie's room and was binding them firmly to Eddie's arm with the belt of his bathrobe and the drawstring from his pajamas. Before she could find the number, there was a knock at the door. Ben and Richie had arrived together. Ben in jeans and an untucked shirt, Richie in a pair of smart gray cotton trousers and his pajama top. His eyes looked warily around the room from behind his glasses.
Christ, Eddie, what happened to...
Oh, my God. Ben cried. He had seen Henry on the floor.
Be quiet, Bill said sharply, and close the door.
Richie did it, his eyes fixed on the body.
Henry?
Ben took three steps toward the corpse and then stopped, as if afraid it might bite him. He looked helplessly at Bill.
You to tell, he said to Eddie. Goddamn stutter is getting worse all the time.
Eddie sketched in what had happened while Beverly hunted up a number for the Derry Public Library and called it. She expected that perhaps Mike had fallen asleep there. He might even have a bunk in his office. What she did not expect was what happened. The phone was picked up on the second ring, and a voice she had never heard before said hello.
Hello, she answered, looking toward the others and making a shushing gesture with one hand. Is Mr. Hanlon there?
Who's this? The voice asked.
She wet her lips with her tongue. Bill was looking at her piercingly. Ben and Richie had looked around. The beginnings of real alarm stirred inside her.
Who are you? She countered. You're not Mr. Hanlon.
I'm Derry Chief of Police Andrew Rademacher, the voice said. Mr. Hanlon is at the Derry Home Hospital right now. He was assaulted and badly wounded a short time ago. Now, who are you, please? I want your name.
But she barely heard this last. Waves of shock rode through her, lifting her dizzily up and up, outside of herself. The muscles in her stomach and legs and crotch all went loose and numb, and she thought in a detached way,
this must be how it happens, when people get so scared they wet their pants. Sure, you just lose control of those muscles.
How badly has he been hurt? She heard herself asking in a papery voice, and then Bill was beside her, his hand on her shoulder, and Ben was there, and Richie, and she felt such a rush of gratitude for them.
She held her free hand out and Bill took it. Richie placed his hand over Bill's and Ben put his over Richie's. Eddie had come over, and now he put his good hand on top.
I want your name, please, Rademacher said briskly, and for a moment the skittering little craven inside of her, the one that had been bred by her father and cared for by her husband, almost answered,
I'm Beverly Marsh and I'm at the Derry Townhouse. Please send Mr. Nell over. There's a dead man here who's still half a boy and we're all very frightened.
She said, I'm afraid I can't tell you, not just yet.
What do you know about this?
Nothing, she said, shocked. What makes you think I do? Jesus Christ.
You just make a habit of calling the library every morning about 3:30, Rademacher said. Is that it? Can the bullshit, young lady. This is assault, and the way the guy looks, it could be murder by the time the sun comes up. I'll ask you again. Who are you, and how much do you know about this?
Closing her eyes, gripping Bill's hand with all her strength, she asked again,
He might die?
You're not just saying that to scare me. He really might die? Please tell me.
He's very badly hurt, and if that doesn't scare you, miss, it ought to. Now, I want to know who you are and why.
As if in a dream, she watched her hand float through space and drop the phone back into the cradle. She looked over at Henry and felt shock as keen as a slap from a cold hand. One of Henry's eyes had closed. The other one, the shattered one, oozed as nakedly as before. Henry seemed to be winking at her.
4. Richie called the hospital. Bill led Beverly over to the bed, where she sat with Eddie, looking off into space. She thought she would cry, but no tears came. The only feeling she was strongly and immediately aware of was a wish that someone would cover Henry Bowers. That winky look was really not cool at all. In one giddy instant, Richie became a reporter from the Derry News. He understood that Mr. Michael Hanlon, the town's head librarian, had been assaulted while working late. Did the hospital have any word on Mr. Hanlon's condition? Richie listened, nodding.
I understand, Mr. Kerpaskian. Do you spell that with two K's?
You do.
Okay. And you are?
He listened, now enough into his own fiction to make doodling motions with one finger as if writing on a pad.
Yes, yes, I understand.
Well, what we usually do in cases like this is to quote you as a source. Then later on we can...
Right. Just right.
Richie laughed heartily and armed a film of sweat from his forehead. He listened again.
Okay, Mr. Kerpaskian. Yes, I got it. Kerpaskian.
Right. Czech Jewish, is it?
Really?
That's most unusual.
Yes, I will.
Good night. Thank you. He hung up and closed his eyes.
Jesus, he cried in a thick, low voice. Jesus, Jesus, Jesus.
He made as if to shove the phone off the table and then simply let his hand fall. He took his glasses off and wiped them on his pajama top.
He's alive but in grave condition, he told the others.
Henry sliced him up like a Christmas turkey. One of the cuts chopped into his femoral artery and he's lost all the blood a man can and still stay alive.
Mike managed to get some kind of tourniquet on it, or he would have been dead when they found him.
Beverly began to cry. She did it like a child, with both hands plastered to her face. For a little while, her hitching sobs and the rapid whistle of Eddie's breathing were the only sounds in the room.
Mike wasn't the only one who got sliced up like a Christmas turkey, Eddie said at last. Henry looked like he just went 12 rounds with Rocky Balboa in a Cuisinart.
Do you still want to go to the police, Bev?
There were Kleenex on the night table, but they were a caked and sodden mass in the middle of a puddle of Perrier. She went into the bathroom, making a wide circle around Henry, got a washcloth, and ran cool water on it. It felt delicious against her hot, puffy face. She felt that she could think clearly again, not rationally, but clearly. She was suddenly aware that rationality would kill them if they tried to use it now. That cop, Rademacher, he had been suspicious. Why not? People didn't call the library at 3:30 in the morning. He had assumed some guilty knowledge. What would he assume if he found out that she had called him from a room where there was a dead man on the floor with a jagged bottleneck planted in his guts? That she and four other strangers had just come into town the day before for a little reunion, and this guy just happened to drop by? Would she buy the tale if the shoe were on the other foot? Would anyone? Of course, they could buttress their tale by adding that they had come back to finish the monster that lived in the drains under the city. That would certainly add a convincing note of gritty realism. She came out of the bathroom and looked at Bill. "No," she said. "I don't want to go to the police. I think Eddie's right. Something might happen to us. Something final. But that isn't the real reason." She looked at the four of them. "We swore it," she said. "We swore. Bill's brother, Stan, all the others, and now Mike. I'm ready, Bill." Bill looked at the others. Richie nodded. "Okay, Big Bill, let's try." Ben said, "The odds look worse than ever. We're too short now." Bill said nothing. "Okay," Ben nodded. "She's right. We swore. Eddie?" Eddie smiled wanly. "I guess I get another pigger back down that ladder, huh? If the ladder's still there." "No one throwing rocks this time, though," Beverly said. "They're dead. All three of them."
"Do we do it now, Bill?" Richie asked.
Yes, Bill said. "I think this is the time."
"Can I say something?"
Ben asked abruptly. Bill looked at him and grinned a little.
Any time."
"You guys are still the best friends I ever had," Ben said. "No matter how this turns out, I just, you know, wanted to tell you that." He looked around at them, and they looked solemnly back at him.
"I'm glad I remembered you," he added.
Richie snorted, Beverly giggled. Then they were all laughing, looking at each other in the old way, in spite of the fact that Mike was in the hospital, perhaps dying, or already dead, in spite of the fact that Eddie's arm was broken, again, in spite of the fact that it was the deepest ditch of the morning. "Haystack, you have such a way with words," Richie said, laughing and wiping his eyes. "He should have been the writer, Big Bill." Still smiling a little, Bill said, "And on that note..." 5. They took Eddie's borrowed limo. Richie drove. The ground fog was thicker now, drifting through the streets like cigarette smoke, not quite reaching the hooded street lamps. The stars overhead were bright chips of ice, spring stars. But by cocking his head to the half-open window on the passenger side, Bill thought he could hear summer thunder in the distance. Rain was being ordered up somewhere over the horizon. Richie turned on the radio, and there was Gene Vincent singing Bebopalula. He hit one of the other buttons and got Buddy Holly. A third punch brought Eddie Cochran singing Summertime Blues. "I'd like to help you, son, but you're too young to vote," a deep voice said.
"Turn it off, Richie," Beverly said softly.
He reached for it, and then his hand froze.
"Stay tuned for more of the Richie Tozier All Dead Rock Show,"
the clown's laughing, screaming voice cried over the finger pops and guitar chops of the Eddie Cochran tune.
"Don't touch that dial. Keep it tuned to the rock pile. They're gone from the charts, but not from our hearts, and you keep coming. Come right along. Come on, everybody. We play all the hits down here. All the hits. And if you don't believe me, just listen to this morning's graveyard shift guest DJ, Georgie Denbro. Tell him, Georgie."
And suddenly Bill's brother was wailing out of the radio.
"You sent me out, and it killed me. I thought it was in the cellar, Big Bill. I thought it was in the cellar, but it was in the drain. It was in the drain, and it killed me. You let it kill me, Big Bill. You let it."
Richie snapped the radio off so hard the knobs spun away and hit the floor mat. "Rock and roll in the sticks really sucks," he said. His voice was not quite steady. "Bev's right. We'll leave it off. What do you say?" No one replied. Bill's face was pale and still and thoughtful under the glow of the passing street lamps, and when the thunder muttered again in the west, they all heard it. 6. In the Barrens. Same old bridge. Richie parked beside it, and they got out and moved to the railing.
Same old railing. And looked down. Same old barrens. It seemed untouched by the last 27 years. To Bill, the turnpike overpass, which was the only new feature, looked unreal, something as ephemeral as a matte painting or a rear-screen projection effect in a movie. Cruddy little trees and scrub bushes glimmered in the twining fog, and Bill thought, I guess this is what we mean when we talk about the persistence of memory. This or something like this, something you see at the right time and from the right angle, image that kicks off emotion like a jet engine. You see it so clear that all the things which happened in between are gone. If desire is what closes the circle between world and want, then the circle has closed. Kaka, come on, he said, and climbed over the railing. They followed him down the embankment in a scatter of scree and pebbles. When they reached the bottom, Bill checked automatically for Silver and then laughed at himself. Silver was leaning against the wall of Mike's garage. It seemed Silver had no part to play in this at all. Although that was strange, after the way it had turned up. To take us there, Bill told Ben. Ben looked at him, and Bill read the thought in his eyes. It's been 27 years, Bill. Dream on. And then he nodded and headed into the undergrowth. The path, their path, had long since grown over, and they had to force themselves through tangles of thorn bushes, prickers, and wild hydrangea so fragrant it was cloying. Crickets sang somnolently all around them, and a few lightning bugs, early arrivals at summer's luscious party, poked at the dark. Bill supposed kids still played down here, but they had made their own runs in secret ways. They came to the clearing where the clubhouse had been, but now there was no clearing here at all. Bushes and lackluster scrub pines had reclaimed it all. Look, Ben whispered, and crossed the clearing. In their memories it was still here, simply overlaid with another of those matte paintings. He yanked at something. It was the mahogany door they had found on the edge of the dump, the one they had used to finish off the clubhouse roof. It had been cast aside here and looked as if it hadn't been touched in a dozen years or more. Creepers were firmly entrenched across its dirty surface. Leave it alone, Haystack, Richie murmured. It's old. Take us there, Ben, Bill repeated from behind them. So they went down to the Kanduskeag, following him, bearing left away from the clearing that didn't exist anymore. The sound of running water grew steadily louder, but they still almost fell into the Kanduskeag before any of them saw it. The foliage had grown up in a tangled wall on the edge of the embankment. The edge broke off under the heels of Ben's cowboy boots, and Bill yanked him back by the scruff of the neck. Thanks, Ben said. De nada. In the old days, you would have pulled me in after you. Down this way? Ben nodded and led them along the overgrown bank, fighting through the tangles of bushes and brambles, thinking how much easier this was when you were only 4'5" and able to go under most tangles. Those in your mind as well as those in your path, he supposed. In one nonchalant duck. Well, everything changed. Our lesson for today, boys and girls, is the more things change, the more things change. Whoever said the more things change, the more things stay the same was obviously suffering severe mental retardation, because... His foot hooked under something and he fell over with a thud, nearly striking his head on the pumping station's concrete cylinder. It was almost completely buried in a wallow of blackberry bushes. As he got to his feet again, he realized that his face and arms and hands had been striped by blackberry thorns in 2 dozen places. Make that 3 dozen, he said, feeling thin blood running down his cheeks. What? Eddie asked. Nothing. He bent down to see what he had tripped over. A root, probably. But it wasn't a root. It was the iron manhole cover. Someone had pushed it off. Of course, Ben thought. We did, 27 years ago. But he realized that was crazy even before he saw fresh metal twinkling through the rust in parallel scrape marks. The pump hadn't been working that day. Sooner or later, someone would have come down to fix it and would have replaced the cover in the bargain. He stood up and the 5 of them gathered around the cylinder and looked in. They could hear the faint sound of dripping water. That was all. Richie had brought all the matches from Eddie's room. Now he lit an entire book of them and tossed it in. For a moment they could see the cylinder's damp inner sleeve and the silent bulk of the pumping machinery. That was all. Could have been off for a long time, Richie said uneasily. Didn't necessarily have to happen to... It's happened fairly recently, Ben said. Since the last rain, anyway. He took another book of matches from Richie, lit one, and pointed out the fresh scratches. There's something under it, Bill said, as Ben shook out the match. What?
Ben asked. Cook couldn't tell. Looked like a strap.
You and Richie helped me to turn it over.
They grabbed the cover and flipped it like a giant coin. This time, Beverly lit the match, and Ben cautiously picked up the purse which had been under the manhole cover. He held it up by the strap. Beverly started to shake out the match and then looked at Bill's face. She froze until the flame touched the ends of her fingers and then dropped it with a little gasp.
Bill, what is it? What's wrong?
Bill's eyes felt too heavy. They couldn't leave that scuffed leather bag with its long leather strap. Suddenly, he could remember the name of the song which had been playing on the radio in the back room of the leather goods shop when he had bought it for her. Sausalito Summer Nights. It was the surpassing weirdism. All the spit was gone out of his mouth, leaving his tongue and inner cheeks as smooth and dry as chrome. He could hear the crickets and see the lightning bugs and smell big green dark growing out of control all around him, and he thought, "It's another trick, another illusion. She's in England, and this is just a cheap shot because it's scared. Oh, yes, it's maybe not as sure as it was when it called us all back. And really, Bill, get serious. How many scuffed leather purses with long straps do you think there are in the world? 1 million? 10 million?
Probably more, but only one like this. He had bought it for Audra in a Burbank leather goods store while Sausalito Summer Nights played on the radio in the back room.
Bill? Beverly's hand on his shoulder, shaking him.
Far away, 27 leagues under the sea.
What was the name of the group that sang Sausalito Summer Nights? Richie would know.
I know, Bill said calmly into Richie's scared, wide-eyed face and smiled. It was Diesel. How's that for total recall?
Bill, what's wrong? Richie whispered.
Bill screamed. He snatched the matches out of Beverly's hand, lit one, and then yanked the purse away from Ben.
Bill, Jesus, what?
He unzipped the purse and turned it over. What fell out was so much Audra that for a moment he was too unmanned to scream again. Amid the Kleenex, sticks of chewing gum, and items of makeup, he saw a tin of Altoid mints and the jewel compact Freddy Firestone had given her when she signed for Attic Room.
My wife's down there, he said, and fell on his knees and began pushing her things back into the purse. He brushed hair that no longer existed out of his eyes without even thinking about it.
Your wife? Audra? Beverly's face was shocked, her eyes huge.
Her purse. Her things.
Jesus, Bill, Richie muttered. That can't be. You know the...
He had found her alligator wallet. He opened it and held it up. Richie lit another match and was looking at a face he had seen in half a dozen movies. The picture on Audra's California driver's license was less glamorous but completely conclusive.
But Henry's dead and Victor and Belch. So who's got her?
He stood up, staring around at them with febrile intensity.
Who's got her?
Ben put a hand on Bill's shoulder. I guess we better go down and find out, huh? Bill looked around at him, as if unsure who Ben might be. And then his eyes cleared.
Yeah, he said. Eddie?
Bill, I'm sorry. Can you climb on?
I did once.
Bill bent over, and Eddie hooked his right arm around Bill's neck. Ben and Richie boosted him up until he could hook his legs around Bill's midsection. As Bill swung one leg clumsily over the lip of the cylinder, Ben saw that Eddie's eyes were tightly shut. And for a moment, he thought he heard the world's ugliest cavalry charge bashing its way through the bushes. He turned, expecting to see the three of them come out of the fog and the brambles. But all he had heard was the rising breeze rattling the bamboo a quarter of a mile or so from here. Their old enemies were all gone now. Bill gripped the rough concrete lip of the cylinder and felt his way down step by step and rung by rung. Eddie had him in a death grip and Bill could barely breathe.
Her purse, dear God, how did her purse get here?
Doesn't matter. But if you're there, God, and if you're taking requests, let her be all right. Don't let her suffer for what Bev and I did tonight, or for what I did one summer when I was a boy. And was it the clown? Was it Bob Gray who got her? If it was, I don't know if even God can help her.
I'm scared, Bill,
Eddie said in a thin voice. Bill's foot touched cold standing water. He lowered himself into it, remembering the feel and the dank smell, remembering the claustrophobic way this place had made him feel, and, just by the way, what had happened to them? How had they fared down in these drains and tunnels? Where exactly had they gone, and how exactly had they gotten out again? He still couldn't remember any of that. All he could think of was Audra.
I am too.
He half-squatted, wincing as the cold water ran into his pants and over his balls, and let Eddie off. They stood shin-deep in the water and watched the others descend the ladder. Chapter 21. Under the City. 1. It. August 1958. Something new had happened. For the first time in forever, something new. Before the universe, there had been only two things. One was itself, and the other was the turtle. The turtle was a stupid old thing that never came out of its shell. It thought that maybe the turtle was dead, had been dead for the last billion years or so. Even if it wasn't, it was still a stupid old thing, and even if the turtle had vomited the universe out whole, that didn't change the fact of its stupidity. It had come here long after the turtle withdrew into its shell, here to Earth, and it had discovered a depth of imagination here that was almost new, almost of concern. This quality of imagination made the food very rich. Its teeth rent flesh gone stiff with exotic terrors and voluptuous fears. They dreamed of night beasts and moving muds. Against their will, they contemplated endless gulfs. Upon this rich food, it existed in a simple cycle of waking to eat and sleeping to dream. It had created a place in its own image, and it looked upon this place with favor from the dead lights which were its eyes. Derry was its killing pen, the people of Derry its sheep. Things had gone on. Then, these children. Something new. For the first time in forever. When it had burst up into the house on Niebolt Street, meaning to kill them all, vaguely uneasy that it had not been able to do so already, and surely that unease had been the first new thing, something had happened which was totally unexpected, utterly unthought of. And there had been pain, pain, great roaring pain all through the shape it had taken. And for one moment there had also been fear, because the only thing it had in common with the stupid old turtle and the cosmology of the macroverse outside the puny egg of this universe was just this. All living things must abide by the laws of the shape they inhabit. For the first time, it realized that perhaps its ability to change its shapes might work against it, as well as for it. There had never been pain before. There had never been fear before. And for a moment, it had thought it might die. Oh, its head had been filled with a great white silver pain, and it had roared and mewled and bellowed, and somehow the children had escaped. But now they were coming. They had entered its domain under the city, seven foolish children blundering through the darkness without lights or weapons. It would kill them now, surely. It had made a great self-discovery. It did not want change or surprise. It did not want new things, ever. It only wanted to eat and sleep and dream and eat again. Following the pain and that brief, bright fear, another new emotion had arisen, as all genuine emotions were new to it, although it was a great mocker of emotions. Anger. It would kill the children because they had, by some amazing accident, hurt it. But it would make them suffer first, because for one brief moment they had made it fear them. Come to me then, it thought. Listening to their approach, come to me, children, and see how we float down here, how we all float. And yet there was a thought that insinuated itself, no matter how strongly it tried to push the thought away. It was simply this. If all things flowed from it, as they surely had done since the turtle sicked up the universe and then fainted inside its shell, how could any creature of this or any other world fool it or hurt it, no matter how briefly or triflingly? How was that possible? And so, a last new thing had come to it, this not an emotion, but a cold speculation. Suppose it had not been alone, as it had always believed. Suppose there was another. And suppose further that these children were agents of that other. Suppose. It began to tremble. Hate was new. Hurt was new. Being crossed in its purpose was new. But the most terrible new thing was this fear. Not fear of the children that had passed, but the fear of not being alone. No, there was no other. Surely there was not. Perhaps because they were children, their imaginations had a certain raw power it had briefly underestimated. But now that they were coming, it would let them come.
They would come, and it would cast them one by one into the macroverse, into the deadlights of its eyes. Yes. When they got here, it would cast them shrieking and insane into the deadlights. 2. In the tunnels. 2:15 p.m. Bev and Richie had maybe 10 matches between them, but Bill wouldn't let them use them. For the time being, at least, there was still dim light in the drain. Not much, but he could make out the next 4 feet in front of him, and as long as he could keep doing that, they would save the matches. He supposed the little light they were getting must be coming from vents and curbings over their heads, maybe even from the circular vents and manhole covers. It seemed surpassingly strange to think they were under the city, but of course by now they must be. The water was deeper now. 3 times dead animals had floated past. A rat, a kitten, a bloated shiny thing that might have been a woodchuck. He heard one of the others mutter disgustedly as that baby cruised by. The water they were crawling through was relatively placid, but all that was going to come to an end fairly soon. There was a steady hollow roaring not too far up ahead. It grew louder, rising to a one-note roar. The drain elbowed to the right. They made the turn, and here were 3 pipes spewing water into their pipe. They were lined up vertically like the lenses on a traffic light. The drain dead-ended here. The light was marginally brighter. Bill looked up and saw they were in a square stone-faced shaft about 15 feet high. There was a sewer grating up there, and water was sloshing down on them in buckets. It was like being in a primitive shower. Bill surveyed the 3 pipes helplessly. The top one was venting water, which was almost clear, although there were leaves and sticks and bits of trash in it. Cigarette butts, chewing gum wrappers, things like that. The middle pipe was venting gray water, and from the lowest one came a grayish-brown flood of lumpy sewage. Eddie. Eddie floundered up beside him. His hair was plastered to his head. His cast was a soaking, drippy mess.
Which one?
If you wanted to know how to build something, you asked Ben. If you wanted to know which way to go, you asked Eddie. They didn't talk about this, but they all knew it. If you were in a strange neighborhood and wanted to get back to a place you knew, Eddie could get you there, making lefts and rights with undiminished confidence until you were reduced simply to following him and hoping that things would turn out right, which they always seemed to do. Bill told Richie once that when he and Eddie first began to play in the Barrens, he, Bill, was constantly afraid of getting lost. Eddie had no such fears, and he always brought the two of them out right where he said he was going to. If I got lost in the Haynesville woods and Eddie was with me, I wouldn't hurry a bit, Bill told Richie. He just knows. My dad says some people hits like they got a humpus in their heads. Eddie's like that.
I can't hear you,
Eddie shouted.
I said, which one? Which one what?
Eddie had his aspirator clutched in his good hand, and Bill thought he actually looked more like a drowned muskrat than a kid.
Which one do we take?
Well, that all depends on where we want to go, Eddie said. And Bill could have cheerfully throttled him, even though the question made perfect sense. Eddie was looking dubiously at the 3 pipes. They could fit into all of them, but the bottom one looked pretty snug. Bill motioned the others to move up into a circle.
Where the fuck is it?
He asked them. Middle of town, Richie said promptly. Right under the middle of town, near the canal. Beverly was nodding. So was Ben. So was Stan.
Mama Mike?
Yes, he said. That's where it is, near the canal, or under it. Bill looked back at Eddie.
Which one?
Eddie pointed reluctantly at the lower pipe. And although Bill's heart sank, he wasn't at all surprised.
That one.
Oh, gross, Stan said unhappily. That's a shit pipe.
We don't...
Mike began and then broke off. He cocked his head in a listening gesture. His eyes were alarmed.
What? Bill began, and Mike put a finger across his lips in a shh gesture.
Now Bill could hear it too, splashing sounds, approaching. Grunts and muffled words. Henry still hadn't given up.
Quick, Ben said. Let's go.
Stan looked back the way they had come. Then he looked at the lowest of the 3 pipes. He pressed his lips tightly together and nodded. Let's go, he said. Shit washes off.
Stan the man gets off a good one, Richie cried. Whacka, whacka, wha. Richie, will you shut up?
Beverly hissed at him.
Bill led them to the pipe, grimacing at the smell, and crawled in. The smell. It was sewage, it was shit, but there was another smell here too, wasn't there? A lower, more vital smell. If an animal's grunt could have a smell, and Bill supposed if the animal in question had been eating the right things, it could. It would be like this undersmell. We're headed in the right direction, all right. It's been here, and it's been here a lot. By the time they had gone 20 feet, the air had grown rancid and poisonous. He squished slowly along, moving through stuff that wasn't mud.